What's the worst Christmas?
Hello, and welcome to episode 11 of If This Is a Podcast, Then What's Christmas? Today, I'm going to be interviewing Dave Dye for the third time. We're going to be looking at his years at BNP DDB, which was the forerunner of DDB London, and some of the really great work he did there before going to work at Abermead Vickers. But I think the other thing I need to do is a little bit of an apology and explanation as to why there was no episode last week. If you've read the blog already, then you'll know that what happened was I spilt a glass of water on my laptop, and that resulted in me losing every single thing on my laptop. I won't go into all the bits and pieces that I lost, but as far as this podcast is concerned, I very sadly and annoyingly lost two really fantastic episodes. One was with Dave, the other one was with Nigel Roberts, who both of whom now I've spoken to again. So this is obviously the Dave episode, and Nigel will be next week. So that was good. One thing I didn't put on the podcast as an additional thing to apologise to Dave about and say thanks for was when we started recording it again, so going through the entire hour one more time, at about the 20-minute mark, I was using my wife's laptop and the spinning beach ball of doom appeared over the screen, and I had to then stop Dave and say, look, I don't know if once I get this computer going again, whether it's going to wipe everything we've just talked about. So we had to start again. So in effect, I did about an hour, then I did another 20 minutes, then I did another hour with Dave. So let me just tell you, if in case you're wondering, he was of enormous patience and understanding about both those two incidents. So I just want to thank him again. It's very kind. And I guess with that little context and explanation, on with episode 11. Okay, so thanks very much for making the time to have a third chat with me, Dave.
No problem.
So I think when we last talked, you were just about to leave Leagues Delaney for BNP. So I wonder if you wanted to just tell us how that came about.
Yeah, I think I mentioned last time that we'd been there about 5 years, had a little taste of approving our own ads, which was good. And I think the system that Tim runs, which is very much a, I still have these things somewhere, if you would hand him your work and it would be marked like schoolwork, which probably seems a bit weird to some people in retrospect, but we didn't mind. But we'd got to the point where we thought, well, perhaps we should take a bit more control now. Tony Cox had contacted us a few months before, and we'd said we weren't interested. But in that time, I'd started to go on a Monday nights with Tony Davison, who I worked with at Liga Salini, to the BNP Creative Department Fireside Football at Paddington Rec every Monday night. We'd finish at Ligas, drive over to Paddington, and have this sort of intense fireside game with the BNP Creative Department on this terrible concrete pitch with lampposts on the inside that you have to navigate like players when you're in the middle of a dribble. So I kind of got used to doing that every Monday, and I got to know most of the creative department there. You know, Nick Gill would come, Richard and Andy, Ewan Patterson, loads of them would all turn up, and they seemed like a nice bunch. And then occasionally we'd talk about, you know, Richard, I remember saying, you should come over, it's really good, it's changing, and, you know, you'd like it. And then a little while afterwards, Tony Cox phoned us again and said, look, do you want to come out to the Chelsea Arts Club? He took me, which felt very grown up at the time. And basically said, look, why don't you come over? And at the time, we'd, after this period of having a bit more responsibility, we thought, yeah, sod it. So we had a few conversations about it. One of the things I felt slightly awkward about is that I was supposed to be head of art and creative director, but they called it docs. They called it directors of creativity for some reason. They arranged the words differently to everyone else. I don't know why. And Mark Reddy had just gone back there after taking a break of about 5 years to be an illustrator. And I thought, oh, I'm going to feel really awkward being head of art when Mark's there. So I said, look, why don't we be joint head of art? You're a brilliant head of art. And also it would allow me more time to create my own stuff. You know, it'd be crazy for you not to do that. And I think he was just sort of finding his way back in the business and was sort of, didn't really want to do it. But it just felt weird to me because I used to share my work to him at various stages of me starting out, you know, trying to get a job somewhere good. You know, several times he tried to get me into BNP when he was there first time around. Yeah, so eventually he agreed and we would join head of art, and then me and Sean were docs.
Okay, I was going to ask how it was when you told Tim that you were leaving.
My memory is it was fine. You know, there wasn't a big drama. There wasn't a big offer to say, well, what if we pay this, do that? I think most people have an impression of Tim that isn't the impression that I had. You know, I worked there for 5 years, and to me, he was always like really smart and funny. I genuinely didn't really have any problems for the 5 years I was there. So, yeah, I don't remember him trying to get us to stay. I mean, he had a really good department, you know, it wasn't like, he had lots of really good people in his department. So, I don't remember it being too dramatic. I think we just felt at the time, you know, particularly me, I've been there longer than Sean, is we needed a change. You know, we'd got used to, I remember listening to Emma talk last time about when she was at Legas, and I think it is very intense, and it is like you're in the trenches, and you know, I remember one headhunter once saying to me, I think it was Liz Harold, I can tell the teams that have worked in Legas Delaney, they've got a certain look in their eyes. And I think that look is a sort of slightly alert, awake, you know, because it was one at the time, particularly, it was produced work faster than anyone else or anywhere else. You had the sort of spectre of Tim ticking and crossing things through it, and you know, always had this reputation of firing people, and it was super, super fast. So, you know, you took away a lot of tools. I'm sure anybody, I'm trying to think of who you spoke to who worked there. I'm sure most people, even if they didn't like Tim, would say they massively learned, you know, X, Y, and Z. You certainly learn how to write. You certainly learn how to be quick. And, you know, he's saying on everything was just write your way out of it. So if we had an hour to do something or there was a big problem, he'd just say write your way out of it, which basically meant just start writing and don't sit there analysing, just start writing and then see where it takes you, which I think is a good piece of advice, because in the process of writing things, you start having ideas even when you're blocked. But, you know, we just got to the point where we needed a change, and the sort of fact that I knew lots of the department, it was a really, you know, BNP had been a good agency for 20 odd years, sometimes better than others. Yeah, it seemed good, you know, it seemed great.
Having worked with Tony a bit myself, it feels like there's a big contrast between him and Tim and maybe BNP and Legas. So how was that working situation in comparison to Legas?
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, in retrospect, and I don't think that we, Sean and I, went there because we thought that's the polar opposite of where we are. I don't think. You just go to whatever you think is going to be the best place. But in retrospect, it was absolutely the polar opposite of where we were. So Tim would be all over every word, let alone every ad or every brief, you know. And Tony wasn't, you know, he would be, you know, at any time of the day you could walk past his office and he would almost certainly have his feet up reading The Guardian, it seemed to me. But the positive of that is that he would empower you. So any time that we had any issues with account people, if there was a sort of standoff between, you know, we think this is the work that answers it, and the account team would say, we don't think the client's going to buy, or that's the answer, or whatever. they would go to Tony, he'd put his guardian down and say, well, I think you need to resolve that with Sean and Dave, Nick, Gil, Britton and Andy, whoever may have it. Carry on reading, and then they'd have to come back and we'd resolve it. Now, the net result of that, I think, is that a lot of really good work was done, and there's not many people who could operate like Tony did, and I think it was often misunderstood as either people thinking, I don't know whether they think he was lazy or, but he was, it worked great. You know, because also the good thing he did is he was really good at hiring. He would spend a lot of time looking into who were the right personalities for the department and, you know, tracking what people did and how they were coming along. And at certain points he would pull them in. And I think, I remember him once saying he viewed it as a bit like casting a dinner party. And he'd say, you don't want all the same sort of person because it would be painful. You want, you know, a contentious, perhaps nasty person. You want some attractive people. You want some oddball people and intelligent people and this type of, you know, you mix them all together and you create an atmosphere and a vibe. And that's kind of how he viewed the creative department. So, you know, if you look at it thoughtfully like that and put it together, then you probably have a bit, you know, it's like that thing of, you know, I used it in a different, I think possibly in the last episode or version that we did, where that Hitchcock quote of, you know, if you cast the right person, you don't have to direct them. And I think to some degree, that's what he did. You know, he got in a good mix of people and let them get on with it. And he sort of totally bought into them and trusted them. So yeah, completely the polar opposite to Tim, but good.
That is kind of fascinating, isn't it? That a job like that you can do in two entirely different ways, one sort of micromanaging every word and one just being very, very hands-off, and have them both be successful. And I mean, I remember when Tony was in charge at AMV for a while, it was funny because I think his last year at BMP, they were British Television Agency of the Year and probably top of the Gum Report. And then as soon as he came to AMV, same thing. So you couldn't really argue that it didn't work. But when you were in it, you were kind of, you couldn't really put your finger on exactly what he did. But I think empowering people and giving them responsibility made you kind of up your own game, because you were kind of like, well, it's all down to me. If this is going to be good or bad, it's not got a safety net of whether the CD has changed lots of it. It's just, you know, it's my responsibility.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it depends on the people there. You know, some people would think, he's empowering me, God, I better pay attention and make sure it's good. And some people would think, oh, we can Skype a bit because he's not all over it. You know, I think most people are probably the former, but yeah, it works with different people in different ways.
Yeah. And so I guess it'd be interesting to start talking about some of the work, because it'll be up on the blog, but one of the campaigns that I think was, you know, that you did that was most awarded and really interesting and different was the VW Polo press ads with the protected shells and protected species and that kind of thing. So how did that come about?
Well, that was a weird one, really. That, I think, well, there's two things. Firstly, when I first went to BMP, one of the first things I did is say, look, on VW, we've all got to go back to Futura, which is, sounds like a small thing, but basically the VW history, they'd had a grid using Futura, a certain weight of Futura, since Bill Burback, Helmut Krohn, started it. And it gradually evolved and changed and loosened and whatever. But for some reason, and if the geeks out there wanted to check in the DNADs of perhaps 96, 97, all the work from BMP, DDB, had stopped using Futura. It was just using all sorts of random faces, whatever suited that particular ad, which seemed partly sacrilegious and partly just didn't really help. It's not like it helped the individual ads, but they just no longer had any connection, any glue. So I said, you know, they would be, not only would they not be worse if we use Futura, they'd be better. So, and they'd all connect. So let's do ads that are a bit more diverse and not quite as gridded as the old VW stuff, but let's at least have some common voice and something visually in common. So we went back to that, was one thing. And then secondly, so we got a brief on polo, which obviously I can't remember what the brief was at the time, but Jeremy and Joe had done a really good ad the year before, not in Futura, which was about protection, and it was like this visual ad, and I can't remember what it said now, but it was like a two-word protection thing, using sort of illustrative icons. And I thought, God, that's really good. You should do. So when we got the brief, I said, why don't you ask Jeremy and Joe to do some more of those? That was really good. And I think they did. The account team did, and Jeremy and Joe said, oh, no, there aren't any more. So the brief came back to us, and we started working on it. And we thought of one that said protected species, because at the time there was a really good campaign that was just all about polo representing protection, because it was small, so you feel more protected when you're in a small space. So we did a thing, it said protected species, and there was lots of species that are protected, like, you know, I can't remember what we had, pandas and various things, and one of them was a human. We thought, well, that's neat, and that's like the last one. So we did it, felt slightly guilty, because I thought, well, that just feels like it's related to Jeremy and Joe's last one. So I went into Jeremy and Joe and said, look, we've done this. It's a bit like your one from last year. Why don't you do another one? We'll have three for a campaign, and we can enter as a campaign because you've sort of done the first bit. And they said, particularly Jeremy, no, there aren't any more. So I said, there must be more. There's loads of, you know, it's only thinking of some protection words and pictures that go through it. It's not rocket science, is it? So anyway, but he was pretty adamant that they'd looked into it and there wasn't any. So anyway, so we did our one, which came out pretty nice. And then we got another brief about 4 months later saying, can you do another one of those? Which we did. I think it was protective shells, and we just had the different shells that protect things. And then we had the shell of the car. And again, I went into Jeremy and Joe and said, look, we've done two. You've done one. Why don't you do another one? And then we've got two of each. No, there aren't any more. So then, well, about 4 months later, we got another brief saying, can you do another one? And we did the protected self-protection. And then we had three, and then it came to awards time. We entered them for awards, and it got a pencil, which I'm sure Jeremy and Joe were delighted about. But it's a shame in a way, because I think we could have done, you know, it's a pretty straightforward format. And they look really good because they didn't particularly look like ads, which had come totally from Jeremy and Joe's initial template, really. We'd slightly rejigged it and used Futura, but it would have been great to do 10 or 20 or something, you know. But I don't know why we didn't do more. I think we had one more that they didn't run in the end. I don't know what happened. Perhaps we left after that. But yeah, it was neat. I mean, you know, in a way, Jeremy and Joe started it, took our lead from that, you know.
Can I ask you a little bit, because I think it did win the Pencil for Art direction. And maybe let's get a little bit technical about it, but I think a couple of the illustrations are sort of nice, friendly drawings, maybe the shells and the species. And then the sort of the Grundy North Edge stuff that was a little bit less like that, although it still had that tone of voice of being kind of nice and friendly, it was done in a different style. What was the thinking behind that being the way to go?
Well, I suppose I thought there was such a strong graphic look to them that whatever little illustration style you dropped onto that sort of yellowy background, they would always hold together. So then I thought, whatever the content is, we'll do it in the best way to represent that one. So I think I've got Jeff Fisher to do the protected species, you know, which sort of were quite charming. I think the protective shells, for whatever reason, I can't remember now, was done as sort of like woodcuts. And then, yeah, Grundy North Edge did the, I guess because self-protection, I thought it would be good to do it like diagrams, you know.
Yeah.
Because it's showing people in different positions. All we had is someone sitting, you know, someone in a sitting position as being the position of protection when they're sitting in a polo, mixed in with, you know, different bits of judo or karate or whatever it was. So it felt like it should be diagrammatic rather than illustrative and loose. So, you know, if we'd have done another 10, I would have picked another, you know, 10 different styles that were appropriate to whatever the protective thing we were talking about, because there was that sort of base that would always hold them all together, you know, so you didn't have to stick to one style, I think. But I mean, the thing that springs to mind with that, an indication of how much trust VW had in the agency, is that when we did the first one, the protected species, I think it was my first meeting with a VW client, the head client, John something, I can't remember his second name. And I'd sort of gone through loads of portfolios and books to try and figure out who it should be and why. Went to a meeting with him, introduced myself, and he said, "What's that?" I said, "Oh, it's the illustrator. It says some of his work." He said, "All right, can he draw people?" So I said, "Yeah, yeah, it's really good." He went, "I'm sure it's fine." And he didn't look. So again, it's a bit like Tony, you know, that's a really empowering thing that you leave and you think, God, what a nice bloke. I want to make sure it's as good as can be, because he's totally trusted. He's got no idea who the illustrator is or what he's like, what style, anything. So I didn't even unzip the book. So, I mean, that's unusual, you know, as I'm sure you'll attest to, you know, that sort of trust.
Yeah.
Which fosters good stuff, you know, when people really trust you like that, it generally pays off, I think.
Absolutely. One other thing I remember about that campaign was I was in a cab with Sean on the way to some post-production place in Soho one afternoon from AMV, and I do have the most puerile sense of humour probably on planet Earth, but I remember that the guy who's the protected man was called Roger Hawes, and as a measure of my absolute puerile mind, I said to Sean, "Were you making a little funny joke there about Roger Hawes as in have sex with prostitutes, Roger Hawes?" And Sean found this pretty funny.
Then you've got to get out more.
I know, I definitely need to get out more, and I think I have done since then. Sean found this quite funny and explained that wasn't the case, which was quite a relief probably. But he said that was the name of the VW client, so maybe...
Was it?
That's what he told me, so maybe...
It's probably true. What I do remember is we did get a letter of complaint from a Roger Hawes, saying that we hadn't consulted him about using his name.
But he thought there were no other Rogers.
And that he was potentially going to sue. So I don't know how unique that is as a name, but yeah, a particular Roger Hawes did write in, and it was a sort of issue that was took up a few meetings on how we should resolve it. Do we need to speak to lawyers, and you know, what do we do? But yeah,
I also remember at that time there was a TV ad done by Richard Nandy that was a sort of martial arts class where people were doing thing. What came first, the chicken or the egg? Because I guess the thing about the position ad that you did, that Grundy Northedge did the illustration for, and that is sort of working off a similar idea. Was there a bit of inspiration between you two there?
No, I think we did our one first. I mean, I think, don't know. I mean, I mean, it sometimes happens. That sometimes does happen, that sort of thing.
One of the other really good campaigns from that time was the American Airlines New York from a new angle. So how did that come about?
I think there was a really, again, it's funny to keep mentioning Richard and Andy with this, but I think that they, you know, before we were there, they'd stirred things up a lot by a sort of very positive can-do attitude, you know, and I think that to me, when I think of BNP now, some of the people were quite old school BNP, and they would only work on certain bits of business, maybe Volkswagen and Sony or whatever. Whereas Richard and Andy would work on anything, you know, and we were like that because we just come from Liga, so we had no option but to work on anything and everything. But there were people who would only work on what they would consider would be good bits of business. So Richard and Andy went there and worked on anything and everything that came through. So it kind of really stirred things up, and I think it created a vibe where it was almost like amongst certain people, you were trying to flip pieces of business from bad to good, you know, and they'd done it with various things. You know, Marmite used to be, this is a brilliant example, used to be not very good, and then all of a sudden it was great. And in a small way, American Airlines used to be run out of, I think it was DDB Chicago, would do all the work, send it out to the various satellite offices, and the work would run through that. I mean, we would literally, presumably the agency would change the phone number and send them a bill. There wasn't much to do. And we didn't even know we had the account, and someone mentioned it. I said, well, can't these ads are garbage that they're doing. Couldn't we ever go out doing our own ones? It's running over here. You know, this is sort of so bland. Can't we make the case that it's not right for this market, as everybody tries to make the same case for not running the same international work? So the account said, well, I'll give it a go. So this, the next one that came up was this sort of slightly weird brief that was something like every week they ran, let me think, six flights to JFK and one to New Jersey. Why you'd want to tell people those figures, I can't imagine. But anyway, that was the brief. Six flights to JFK, one to New Jersey every week. Seems so ridiculous now. Anyway, we did this poster, which was a sort of gridded up thing of six pictures of JFK photographs, and seven pictures of JFK, and on the third one, he had a big yellow polo neck jumper coming up to just under his nose, and it said six JFK, one New Jersey, or something like that. A bit of a weird brief, and a slightly weird ad, but it looked quite funny. And bizarrely, they bought it. So not only did they buy our work, but they bought a sort of weird, slightly weird, wacky, for me anyway, sort of ad. And they quite liked it. And obviously the American Airlines people in London or the UK quite liked the idea of doing, they thought, actually, it's quite fun to do our own thing rather than do nothing. So then just before Christmas, I think it was, we got another brief and they said, oh, there's a potential campaign we could do. And we said, okay, great, what is it? And they said, they want to do some posters saying that they now fly out of Newark. So I said, okay, great, well, what's the brief? That's it, just that they fly out of Newark. So I said, well, why would you do that? Well, it's not really a reason. There's not a reason as such. I said, is it quicker to New York? Or no, not really. So we went through a whole list of, is it this, is it that? Nothing. So I said, boys, so there's no reason to do this at all. It's just, if you fancy going to that one rather than that one, then we're the guys. I thought, God, they sent such a non-brief. So we were sort of kicking around. How do we say you could do this one for a change? So we did this thing, New York. So we wrote New York from a different angle, which is not like an amazing statement, is it? Because it's just saying approach it from a different angle. There's no benefit in that. But anyway, it's the best we could. We thought, well, let's say New York from a new angle, and then we can shoot New York from different angles, which would look quite nice, and then they bought it, and we shot about six of them. And I remember giving Dave Wakefield a reference of, there's the beginning of North by Northwest, when all the type is sliding on angles across different buildings, saying, can't we do something like that? It'd be great. We'll shoot all the New York from weird angles, and the type can be at angles too, and it could look quite cool. You know, it's more of a sort of designy thing than a sort of concrete ad proposition thing, but it could look cool. And then we sent Jonathan back to New York and said, could you spend a week or two shooting New York from various interesting angles, and we're going to put tarp on. So he did that. Dave Wakefield, you know, did all the type, which I seem to remember he didn't use a Mac. He was insistent that we shouldn't use a Mac because it would look crap. So presumably that must have been done, would that have been drawn on Grant projectors or something? He didn't use a Mac, and the type does look good. You know, even now it looks, it's got a sort of quality to it that doesn't feel like it's been squeezed or compressed on a Mac. So he was obviously right. Yeah, so it came out well, and I think from then on, you know, they would do some pretty good stuff. I think Mark worked on it, and various people worked on it after that, and they had a little run of doing some quite nice stuff. In fact, I think then it went over to, when Mark went to McCann's, and he continued working on American Airlines and did some really cool stuff on it. So,
and I guess that is consistent with the slight theme of what we were talking about with, you know, Tony giving you trust and responsibility and that VW client. When you're commissioning a photographer and just saying, can you go off to New York? I mean, most of the shoots I've done, either my art director or I or both of us have been sort of, you go to the shoot yourself and just make sure everything's shot the way you want, or at least things might change on the shoot, so you might want to be there and that kind of stuff. So sending someone off and not being with them for those shots, is that how you normally approach photography, or was it different?
Yeah, well, it is really, because I think, you know, when we're talking about empowerment, that Tony Cox empowering us and saying, look, I believe in you, you do what you think's right, is good. You know, it's a good thing to do, because it makes people concentrate. And I think, you know, the minute you turn up on a shoot and you're looking through a lens and you're pointing at things, you're sort of responsible, not the photographer, really. Some photographers switch off, you know. And I think it's good to slightly be on edge for them to think, well, is this good enough or is this not good enough? You know, I remember Malcolm Venville, a mate of mine, getting his first job from Mark Reddy. And just before the shoot, Mark said, oh, yeah, I won't be there on the actual shoot, so good luck. And I was completely freaked out. He sort of realised, Jesus, it's all down to me then. And you go, well, you're a photographer. And it made him absolutely focus and double-check everything and think about everything. You know, and again, I suppose it depends on the photographer, but I think it's a, you know, I think that if I've got so many views on it, the precise angle and how far away, and is it this thing or that thing, I should get a camera and do it myself. What I want to buy into is someone's talent I want to give them the thought. So the thought is, we're going to see New York from surprising angles. It's a good brief for a photographer. It's a great brief. It can't go too far wrong. You know, what's the worst? If you pick a good photographer, what's the worst that can happen?
Yeah.
You know. Sure. The things that are going to come back from different angles, they might not be, you know, as surprising, or I don't know, what's the worst that can happen? The worst that could happen is you might not like them really a lot, but, you know, it's not going to be completely a million miles away. And I suppose that's what I used to do on Adidas. So I prefer briefing people with the kernel of the idea and then letting them interpret it, rather than standing on their shoulder, telling them left a bit, up a bit, move a bit. You know, sometimes that involve people that you have to be there, because it's all about the moment, it's all about the expression or whatever. But I think, I mean, again, it's like that Hitchcock thing. You know, if you cast the right photographer, you don't need to art direct them too much. And also it forces you to really zoom in on what the idea is, what you're asking them to do.
Yeah.
You know, you have to crystallise it down and be really clear to say, you've got a lot of latitude, but what I absolutely need is shots of New York from unusual angles. That's non-negotiable. What it is after that, enjoy yourself. You know, you do what you do. I want it to be like your personal shot. I want you to be proud of it. But that's the bit that I need for my end. So for me, generally, that gets better, you know, that gets better results, because the photographers feel engaged.
Yeah, I think one of the other, I mean, it'd be interesting to talk about another one of the photos you commissioned in the context of what you just said. But the Sony camcorder one with a bloke who seems to be balancing on his nose in a garden, that always sort of fascinated me at the time. I'm going, what a weird shot and what a weird place to have it. And did you know there was a bloke who could balance on his nose and you just went, could someone take a photo? Or did the photographer, I don't really understand where that would have come from.
Well, we did a campaign for Sony, campaign of spreads. And there was a photographer I always loved called Jeff Kern.
Yeah,
and he came over to England and he shot five or six of them. And they were sort of okay. They weren't amazing, you know. And the ads were sort of okay. And the shots were sort of okay. Anyway, as we were sort of wrapping it up, the client said, oh, we need one more. And it was, I get their briefs muddled up sometimes, but I think it was on Battery Life, it must have been on Battery Life. So it's battery life for the camera. So we thought, okay, what can you do on that? Battery life. So what's the problem with battery life? How do you bring that to life? Rather than just say, get an extra 2 hours, which is almost meaningless. You think, okay, the problem with that is that just as you're about to capture something that you're never going to see again, the camera goes dead. So what could you see that you'd think, Wow, I've got to get a picture of that. So we probably would have went through I've got a memory, we went through all sorts of nonsense, stupid things that people could be doing, or things that could be happening. And obviously, partly you're in the world of, if you're not careful, you're in the world of cliche where you get, you know, a big oversized X or a big, you know, you see lots of that, particularly on Facebook, you know, wow, you'll never believe X, and then you see this crazy picture. And sometimes when you go the other way and you make it very small, it's funnier and more unusual. So someone balancing on their nose, rather than saying, you know, you see a giant walk past or some crazy, you know, Bigfoot or something, which is very cliched, reducing it to just as if someone is balancing on his nose and you think, quick, I've got to get that now, seemed funny. It seemed a bit stupid. So I did a little sketch of it, sent it over to Jeff, and he shot it in his back garden and sent it back. And it was best picture that he did. I mean, it's the best concept, but it was also the best picture. And he just shot it in his back garden. He hung the guy up on a, you know, with rope around his legs and a crane.
Okay.
Dangled him down and then retouched the rope out. So it's pretty. Didn't have to cast an actual nose stander. This was cheated. But in a way, things like that work quite well because it's not a crazy amount of retouching. Everything is, you know, there's a 2% of it is retouched, but the effect is good. But yeah, so he just shot it in his back garden and it worked out well. It was the best shot and it did pretty well in the awards. None of the others did, but he knocked it off in his garden.
The other interesting thing about that, I'm just going to get really nerdy about it, is what the guy's wearing. He looks like one of those Monty Python characters who has like a hanky round his head, like he's wearing a sort of sleeveless jumper and one of those things. So he almost looks like the kind of weirdo who might balance on his nose. So I think it all the elements came together in a way that made the picture just right.
Yeah, well, I think that's the sort of thing that he's really good at, Jeff. I don't know whether you know his work, but he's great at those little odd, you know, he would think through that. That wouldn't be an accident. In fact, I've even got a feeling that's his assistant. I could be wrong there, but he would be on to that vibe. You know, he wouldn't just knock it out. He'd think he needs to look a bit nerdy or geeky or, you know. But, you know, I like that picture. It's funny. It's just sort of silly thing. But
yeah. I remember having a chat with you at AMV after you'd been there for a little while. We were talking about Budweiser, and you told me that you thought it was the best campaign you had done. And, you know, obviously that's up against some pretty good competition. And yet, weirdly enough, it was probably one of the least awarded ones in that way. I mean, for what is a really, really good campaign. So I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about, I mean, either why you think it was the best thing that you did or why it didn't get awarded as much as it should have done.
Yeah, I don't know. I think I didn't really like that. I think, I don't know. I mean, it started in a weird place. I remember that Budweiser at the time were, I don't know whether it's any different now, but they were seen as a sort of big, slightly bland brewery. They wanted to be much cooler. They wanted to go in the style magazines. And the debate that was being had with planning was, it would be great to say that we've been around 100 and something years, but obviously that's really boring for style magazines, because they'd imagined sort of ads that would have tons of copy and, you know, whatever. You know, we've got to do something cool. So we thought, well, as long as you, there's no reason you couldn't say we've been around for 100 and something years in a cool way. And I think, again, referencing Emma's experience of going from Legas to BNP, you know, we were conscious, you know, we would write a lot, and people at BNP didn't really like words too much. You know, it was almost like it was cheating coming up with a headline. So, you know, we would be competitive, so we'd go, well, we'll try and not to use any words, because, you know, they seem to be so disparaging about Legas style work. Which again, in retrospect, is quite useful. So lots of the work we would do, you'd go, well, let's have no words or as few words as we possibly can. And not only that, let's try and come up with new structures. Let's come up with a structure that isn't like either just a big visual and a little couple of words in the corner, or certainly not a headline. So we kind of got into that vibe, and I think when we got that brief, we thought, let's just do this 100 plus years in a really cool way, which we come up with this structure of, which I really like those in situ, because you've just got those three pictures coming out of the gutter or butting into the gutter, whatever it was. They just didn't look like ads. They sort of looked very odd. There's no logos anywhere. There's no patch shots. I mean, there is buried in one of the shots, but they were really difficult to ignore. And again, incredibly distinctive, but totally dead clear and cool, I thought. And weirdly, you know, it was going, I think we did that towards the end of when we were at BNP, and it was going well then. And I think there was a sort of slightly cocky vibe about it. You know, the agency was the campaigns agency of the year. We were headed top of the Gum Report, you know, got lots of golds and silvers at DNAD. Anyway, before the agency entered DNAD, there was a sort of, amongst all the docs, a sort of gambling. So you had to write your top three award-winning pieces of what's going to do best from the agency at DNAD this year. And everybody sort of did it blind, put in a tenner or whatever it was. And that came out as the number one across everyone. So, you know, Nick Gill, Richard and Andy, Jeremy Craig, and all sorts of really good people. That's the sort of most likely to do, it's the thing that's going to do the best at DNAD from BNP that year. And I don't think it got in. I think it got gold at the one show, but I don't think it got into DNAD. So it just shows, you know, you don't know. There are really good people who would have been judging that, but didn't even get in. So I liked it. It's one of my favourite things probably, because it's reduced down to it's very relevant. It really stands out, and it's cool.
I was just going to say, when I spoke to Paul Burke, he mentioned a little bit about John Webster. I guess he was there when you were there as well. What did you come into contact with him very much? What was it like?
Yeah, well, I suppose we partly thought it'd be great to learn from him. You know, the best TV writer, creator ever, you know, in this country. So we were really keen on trying to learn from him. But it wasn't really his thing. You know, we had a few experiences. I remember we once went in with a script, you know, not long after we got there on a piece of business. He was also a doc, and he kind of read through it. You know, you sit there all nervously, laughing his head off, you know, he's laughing, read on, head back, laughing, shoulders going. So we went from being nervous to thinking, well, you know, it's not bad, we could do better. But it's... And he got to him and, yeah, very derivative, I think. And that was it. And then we shuffled out under the door. And he didn't get too involved with other people's work, really. You know, I think what was interesting hearing Paul talk about him, I think he liked doing his own stuff, you know, a bit like David Abbott in a way. You know, he didn't really want to be creative director as such. If there was an idea that someone had done that he liked, he'd work on it as if it was his own sort of thing. But I don't think he wanted to go away and rewrite this. Not that I saw anyone. And I think Richard and Andy had the same similar sort of experience. But
I remember, I think I was talking to Dylan Harrison about this before. He said that what John did that was brilliant was that he knew when all the meetings were happening in all the presentations for the ads. And once an ad had been, you know, the campaigns had been rejected for a while and it was coming up to the absolute deadline of something having to run, he would whip a great ad out of his bottom drawer or whatever, yeah, and be the sort of conquering hero just riding in on his white charger, which sounds like a really clever way of getting stuff made. I don't know if you saw any of that.
Yeah, I mean, good for him. I mean, he would have had years and years of doing it. I think it's funny how he'd been there 25 years when we were there, and it's funny how they sort of took him for granted to some degree. I remember he worked on a pitch, you know, about 1998, and he presented his stuff, and one of the people in the room was Chris Power, who was the CEO, and he presented his stuff, and he had like a character. I remember Chris Power going, oh, for fuck's sake, John, not another gonk. And I mean, that's just it seems incredible now, but you know, there's a, it just shows, you know, when you're sort of familiar with these people day in, day out, and they're showing you their furry characters or their animated, you know, it was like, oh, fucking go on, come on, let's do something modern. But yeah, no, he was, you know, he was still doing really good work when we were there.
Yeah, I think he won a pencil for some online thing, like in the early 2000s. There was some bank or Compaq Computers or something.
Oh yeah, Compaq.
And so
yeah,
he won a pencil for that. And I was like, that really boggled my mind, because it was kind of, okay, in the new medium, John has done it again and won a pencil. So, you know, he was just always great. I don't know if the chronology is right, but did Tony leave to go to AMV before you did? Or
Yeah. So basically they got in, I have no idea why, but we had this system of docs, which kind of felt like it was great for us, because we would all know what was going on. And, you know, if, you know, Nick Gill or something had was really keen on a campaign and it hadn't sold, and then they come over to us to rebrief us on it, we would go and check with Nick and say, look, we've been, the guys have been over, haven't you got, weren't you pushing something on that? And they couldn't, it was almost like it was unionized, which was great for the creative people, because it meant you could push and stick by all the work you believed in most, but probably a nightmare for the, particularly the account people. I would imagine because of that, after a while, you know, again, you sort of take the success for granted that we were top of the gun report and the work was good. You sort of, it's one of those things, you take that and think, well, we'll keep that, but we'll get someone in who's going to loosen it up a bit, because this bit's a pain. So all of a sudden one day we were told, new ECD, Larry Barker, which seemed, thought that's weird, because the creative work's doing so well. You know, I wonder why we've got a new ECD. Plus Tony's not going. How strange, what's that about? So Larry turned up. I think there was talk of adjusting Tony's salary, which didn't go down very well. So after a while, Tony left and went to Abbott Mead. And what you had then is, you know, that's when you got more of a sense of how Tony ran it and what you lost, because you had a different system now. I mean, anybody who turns up has got to, they've got to do something. They've got to change, you almost got to change something. So Larry had a system where we would have to, I think they would present three campaigns on every route to the client, and they would involve the account people in making that choice. You know, so completely turn the whole thing on its head. And I would imagine they've done that because that was his brief. I can only imagine that was his brief. You know, Larry was good. He'd done really good work. And I can't imagine why he would turn up and make those changes unless that was the brief. So all of a sudden, we're in a situation where instead of controlling things and having the ultimate say on what works going forward, it was all sort of thrown into Larry's room, and then the result would come out. And you couldn't just turn up like you could to Tony and say, oh, I've got a problem on this thing, and he put down his guardian. You had to book in time, and it was just a completely different way of doing things that was difficult to adjust to, because it was almost nirvana how it was before. Everybody, all the creators loved it, and it was doing really, really well creatively. And that's when he'd gone.
Yeah, I find that, I mean, I'd love to talk to Larry, and maybe I will at some point in the future, but I find it interesting that someone who is a person who's been a great creative themselves would then, first to disrupt what was already going really well. Obviously, you know, if you're getting the call and someone goes, do you want to be the ECD of BNP, you probably would say yes anyway. But to put in something where you go, everyone's got to do three routes, because, I mean, as a creative, you got to know that coming up with something amazing once is still quite hard. Coming up with two or three amazing things is very hard, and then leaving the choice up to the client is then, you know, taking, you know, your creativity out of your hands and putting it into someone else's. So I'd be really interested to see what his kind of motivation was there, what he was trying to achieve.
Yeah, I mean, Yeah, so would I. I mean, I that's my memory of it. I don't know how accurate that would be. But, you know, it's difficult, isn't it? I mean, the problem we have in our business is that it's so subjective. It's not maths, you know, so you can't. It's all opinion and gut. And, you know, when you go through, when I hear any examples of people talking about their work and, you know, what came out good, it's such a, as much as you try and analyze it and rationalize it and come up with, you know, essentially it's a sort of gut visceral thing, isn't it? I think often. So, yeah, it's difficult. So, you know, if you, I can understand from a B&B point of view, if they say, it's a, they're all a pain, all these people with their opinions saying it has to be this, it can only be that, and we have to use this word and that word. I mean, I can imagine them thinking it's such a pain in the arse. If we didn't have all these people with their immovable views, we'd be winning more business and making more money. Yeah. So I can understand where they come from, and it's very difficult to say the only way is what they say. There's obviously thousands of ways, but ultimately what happened is they went down that route, and initially all the account people were ecstatic because all of a sudden they were making the calls on the creative work as much as anyone, whereas before they weren't as involved as they wanted to be. And but I remember catching up with them a year later. I bumped into a group of them and they hated it because they'd gone from having to sell and persuade people to do what the agency wanted, which is tough and painful, and they'd have to come back and say, we can't get the client to do it. But they had a really important, strong role to, these are the ones, what do you think's best? You know, I'm sure they didn't do it like that, but essentially they felt like they had less of a role. It was much more, when you're giving people choice every time, they felt a bit less valued, ironically. So as much as it was great at the beginning, they sort of, even the account people ended up not liking that system, although most people seem to operate that system today.
But. Yeah. And was that change of regime what kind of led to you wanting to leave?
Yeah. I think it just felt very, I don't know. I think it felt very different. There was a number of people had gone, Richard and Andy had gone, Tony had gone. You know, it was very difficult to adjust to this new system that didn't seem to value the work. So I thought, well, you can either stay and moan about it or find a new challenge. And I think Peter phoned up again from Abbott Mead. There was two places we were talking to, and one was M&C Saatchi, which would have been sort of interesting. I'm trying to think how old they would have been. Relatively young. Obviously, Saatchi's was amazing. They'd broken away and it hadn't quite done as well creatively as people had expected. So we talked to them about, I suppose, me being the sort of third creative director with James and...
Jeremy?
Not Jeremy Sinclair, the...
Simon Dickett?
Simon, James yeah. And Simon. And, you know, it's quite interesting, the thought of trying to improve that and get that going, and that was quite exciting. And then at the same time, Abbott Mead. And they were very different agencies and very different offers. And I remember talking to a friend of mine, Derek Haas, sort of taking him through, you know, this complex web of, well, it's really difficult because Abbott Mead are more established and have done slightly better awards, but there's probably a bit more integral there. There's equity there. There's this thing and that thing. But then over here, they've got this account and this account, and went through this massive, big, complicated matrix of how, you know, how do you unpick such a tricky decision as this? And he said, I know what you should do. I said, what? He said, go to Abbott Mead. So I said, okay, that's interesting. What's your thinking? He went, it's better. I said, yeah, that's a good point. I'll get bogged down in the detail. So we went to Abbott Mead because it was better. And he was right, you know.
Yeah, I think some people listening to this might want to get a little bit of perspective on how you and Sean worked as a dynamic in terms of, because I think when people move agencies, particularly, you know, there may be one of you wants to do one thing, one of you wants to do the other. Should we stay? Should we go? Is it the right move? Is it not? Was that a dynamic where you and Sean talked about those things a lot, or did he kind of leave that up to you, or how did that work?
I guess I would probably, you know, I guess I would probably lead those things, I would say. I think there's certain aspects, I don't like talking too much about, I don't, for Sean, because...
Yeah, sure.
But I think there's certain aspects that he likes solving problems, doing ideas, and there's other aspects he has no time for. You know, I mean, at BNP, I hope you won't mind me saying, but at BNP, we would... at BNP, the planners were all smart, but sometimes they'd really massively over-intellectualise things, you know. So a BW brief with £1,000 off would turn into some brief about evolving your lifestyle into, you know, some, you know, it would be such a complicated thing sometimes. Anyway, and it would take ages. So often the planners would come into our room, and as they would get to the door, Sean would pick up his cigarettes and say, "I'll see you later. Can you let me know what they said?" And he'd laugh at them in a charming way, and they'd laugh and think, "Charming old Sean." And he'd go and have a cigarette because he couldn't bear the hell of listening to all this bullshit, as he'd say. So then I suppose between us, we had a good, you know, I worked with Sean over 10 years, I think. So I think probably the teams that work best as teams slightly divide and conquer a bit, not, don't completely overlap on everything. And I think some of the more sensible things, perhaps, like should we go here or there, I would imagine I was probably a bit more vocal on than him.
It's funny because I remember actually, and I'm only just remembering this now, you're talking about this, Paul and I had a crit with Sean at BNP, and... we rang him up, and it was just with him. And I think he said, "Can you do it at 8:30 in the morning?" And which was slightly unusual for people as a time to do a crit. And we went and had a chat with him, and we asked, not like, did it have to be 8:30? We were like, why so early? And he said, well, because he got his work done at the beginning and end of the day. In the middle, there was so much interference from, you know, planners or account guys that he just never got anything done, so he would get there really early. I don't know if he was still travelling down from Leeds at that point.
He wouldn't have been, no, not at that point. He was in London.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, that's the, there you go. So, and that's sort of partly true. Some of it would have been time-wasting interference, but obviously you can't opt out of it completely, so one of you has to do it. But,
yeah.
So we, you know, there were certain, you know, as you... get more senior, I suppose, as a team. You know, initially at Legas, we'd be locked in a room all day, pushing ideas backwards and forwards, arguing and not coming out, really. And then as you start to get a bit more responsibility and overseeing other teams and stuff, you get more and more people coming in the room, and it changes the sort of dynamic. So I think his dynamic, I mean, it's funny, I think back now at Legas, we'd be sitting there, and he'd be smoking in the room with the doors locked, waving his arm to push the smoke away from, you know, kindly pushing the smoke away from my side of the room so that I can get a disease. And, as you go on, you then start to deal with more people are interrupting. You're not just, can you do this brief and that brief? And that's generally those are the things he likes less.
Cool. And I think we're going to be just about coming to AMV. So was there also something in the... I'm just going to say, I spoke to Nigel about when he and Paul came to AMV, and he said it was the perfect situation because Peter sort of dealt with all the politics and the overall agency running stuff and kind of left him and Paul to really just make the work better. And he said that was like paradise to him. Was that the thing you were kind of offered at AMV, or was that the competition you wanted to get things into there?
Not really. I mean, we'd really enjoyed BNP. It was changing, so we wanted a new challenge. I mean, again, funnily enough, we were mates with Tom and Walter. It's funny, having a connection somewhere is helpful because they sort of, you know, it's a bit less threatening and they can sort of tell you a bit more what it's like. And also they would, Tom, obviously, at the time, AMV were doing well. Tom Walter were doing particularly well. Tony had gone there, who we knew, who was joint ECD. I'd met Peter once or twice, I think, who'd offered us something and we hadn't done it. But so it wasn't a hard, you know, it was the biggest agency in the country doing some of the best work. It was for me to replace Ron as head of art, and I had lots of good people there, you know, so it was a, yeah, it's not, not, it was an easy decision to make, really.
Great. Well, I think that is a good dividing line, that if we're just going to go agency by agency, take an hour over each one. Well, I think we're now going to go into AMV, but we're at the hour point, so I think we could stop the BNP conversation there. Obviously, there've been some great stories and things to learn from. We can do a part four, and God knows how many after that. Maybe a couple more at some point in the future. But thanks again for the sort of 3.5 or 4th time now that you've made the time to speak to me, and let's chat again soon.
All right, sorry it's so slow.
Oh, that's no problem. Cheers, thanks a lot. Cheers, Dave.
All the best. Bye.
Bye.